From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, a group of Waldo parents are pushing to open a neighborhood school.
Because it's really not just the responsibility of the district to educate our children, it's the entire community's responsibility.
Plus, historical practices that led to shortcomings in social integration today.
You know, all these real estate developers, there was basically a J.C. Nichols in every major city, and they were all friends. And they were the ones who made it part of a realtor's code of ethics nationwide that introducing unfamiliar ethnic group to an all-white neighborhood is, you know, destabilizing.
And the aftermath of a dry summer on some area farmers.
I honestly probably wanted to quit several times. Just hang it up.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
This week, the African-centered College Preparatory Academy removed 50 students from its program after fighting and phony fire alarms the previous Friday. On Wednesday, the school held a meeting for parents to explain the action and describe new policies following what's been a difficult semester. Alex Smith was there and talked to some of the 150 parents in attendance.
I just wanted to just be here and see what they were talking about and the agenda and what they proposed for the school. I took my kids out today and put them in another school, but I just still want to see if some of the teachers and the staff is going to hold themselves also accountable for some of the things that went on.
They didn't take the right steps in getting the students transferred over here to this school because it was fine when it was before the district came back in. It was fine as far as discipline problems. It was fine. When they came back in is when all the problems start happening. So they let too many kids in here without knowing exactly where they were going with the process.
The school district, I'm not happy with them at all, because they're part of the problem. So rushing out here, looking over everybody's shoulders the last few days has not impressed me, because they've been part of the problem in Kansas City for the last 20 years.
The students that have been here at ACE are students that excel. They've been pushed and they've been, I guess, mentored to excel from their parents and the school. And sometimes when you mix those students that may not necessarily be at that level, or maybe the structure at other schools may not have been how it was before. And when you mix people, you get some type of chaos. And sometimes the disorganization, again, of a new school just makes it more difficult to manage. I think there's way too many kids in here, way too many. I feel sorry for the teachers, too.
African-centered education in Kansas City, Missouri started at Chick Elementary School in 1991. Since then, it's expanded to include K through 12. All grades are now taught at the former Southeast High School campus. For the past few years, the school had been run by a contractor, African-Centered Education Task Force Incorporated, but disputes with that company caused the district to take over operations this summer. The school expected about 350 students for 7th through 12th grades this fall, but 750 enrolled. At Wednesday's meeting, the new principal, Joseph Williams, acknowledged the problems, like fights and understaffing, that the school has experienced this semester.
We started off rough. Look, I'll be the first to say that I've been doing this for 20 years. This has been the toughest 8 weeks of my education career. I'll say that point blank.
Principal Williams and Assistant Superintendent Dr. Ann Sanders addressed the parents and took their questions. Dr. Sanders announced the school would begin a zero-tolerance policy for misbehavior.
What we believe in and you believe in and that we possibly all have had in our lives are second chances. And so we gave some children, all of the children, second chances. However, some of them took advantage, and some of your children then were negatively impacted. What we have been doing then is looking at the criteria, and those children are going to be given the opportunity to go to their neighborhood school.
Additionally, Williams and Sanders announced a temporary increase in security, a minimum 2.35 GPA for the year, increased scrutiny of teacher performance, and increased enforcement of the school's uniform policy. They also said the school would bring back the interview as part of the student selection process. The school has also added a number of new teachers since the beginning of the semester. After the meeting, many parents said they were satisfied with what they heard, but they'd be watching closely. Donna Jackson's daughter is a senior, and she says 15 of her daughter's classmates have left the school this semester. It's a trend she wants to see come to an end.
I'm on a wait-and-see basis right now. My daughter, she started the seventh grade, and she's a senior this year, so I would really hate to have to pull her out at this late date, you know, and go someplace else. I'm frustrated, you know. I don't want her. She wanted to graduate. That's the only reason why she was here. She wanted to graduate with her senior class. And a lot of them have already left, so we'll see.
For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
While some Kansas City, Missouri parents are fighting to keep their kids' school on track, others are trying to woo the district to start a new school in their neighborhood. Alex has their story.
Okay, so how do we, who wants to be what? Does anyone care?
Me.
What number do you want to be?
What number are we going to be?
One.
You're going to be number one. Okay, so we're going to make that for you right now.
For the past several weeks, a group of mostly 30-something parents has gathered at a coffee shop in Waldo with plenty of babies and toddlers in tow. Like a lot of parents who live in Kansas City, Missouri, the group members are concerned about the performance of local public schools. Thinking about their child's education, a lot of KCMO parents face a huge question. Should I move to Kansas or relocate to a Missouri suburb? But for the members of this coffee shop crew, the answer is a resounding no.
After we bought our house, I really just started having a big interest in the rich history of this area, of the city as a whole, and really see a problem with the current situation in the school district. I'm an engineer professionally, and just when I see a problem, I like to try to solve it. So,
but I came to Kansas City as an advocate for sustainability and urban development that benefits kind of social equity across communities, and a viable public school system is the most important thing to the success of our city in the long term, both for economic development but also for social equity and other issues that I think our city currently faces.
I would not consider moving to Kansas because I feel like my voice would be lost politically if I moved over to Kansas. And I have many people who've said the same thing. So, no, it's not an option for us. But even, like, the moving to Kansas, moving outside of the Kansas City, Missouri school district, it's not an option for us. We're here for the long haul.
Rather than split town, the Friends of Hale Cook are digging in. They're working to get the district to open a new school in Waldo, and they've been canvassing the area for the past few months to spread the message and get support. They're not pushing for a charter or Montessori school. The Friends of Hale Cook want an old-fashioned neighborhood school. The group's president, Ashley Hand, explains.
We are qualifying ourselves as a neighborhood school, being that there would be no busing as a way of not only saving on the cost per student to put that money into the actual administration of the building and teaching of the children and not on transportation, but also because we feel that there's a higher level of investment in the outcome of a public school when parents and community members can be directly involved with the school itself. But it also allows us an opportunity to bring in resources that the district might not have otherwise by bringing in community organizations and partners that can help meet the needs of the children by, you know, extending the type of extracurricular activities that the school might like to have but the district might not be able to offer, but also bring in volunteers and things like that to lend support to the teachers and the administrators, because it's really not just the responsibility of the district to educate our children, it's the entire community's responsibility.
About 2 years ago, Waldo neighborhood members decided they wanted the empty Hale Cook Elementary building at 73rd and Pennsylvania reopened. When they first approached the KCMO district, they said, sure, as long as you can get full enrollment on the first day. The Friends of Hale Cook knew that finding nearly 350 new students was probably impossible. So, as Ashley Hand explains, they worked with the district and interim superintendent Dr. Stephen Green to find an alternate approach.
We are in the process of completing a feasibility study where we've done a very broad survey of the community in the neighborhood adjacent to the school to determine how they would support, if they would support, attending a neighborhood school. So that's one part. We've also gone out to community organizations, businesses, and other partners that we feel will help support a neighborhood school in the future to ensure that we have their support now.
Han says the current strategy is to start small, really small. They want to launch the preschool and kindergarten programs first and reopen the rest of the school in stages over the course of several years. With the feasibility study, the Friends of Hale Cook are also trying to demonstrate the school will have new students to start not just in fall of 2013, but in future years as well.
Right now, we're actively looking for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds for fall 2013. But we are also looking for families such as myself and Sarah Darmitzel and Sarah Wozinski, who are also on our board, whose children are not yet of school age, but would like to attend a neighborhood school, because we'd like to show the district that year one may be small and we may only have a few classes filled, but over the years we see by the demographics in the neighborhood this potential growth, because we'll be retaining those families that might otherwise choose to go to a parochial school, leave the neighborhood entirely by moving across state lines or out of Kansas City proper, or try to find another alternative for educating their children.
All right, well, let's walk towards the school.
Okay.
After figuring out the morning's plan to canvass the neighborhood, the group starts its march toward the empty school building just a few blocks north. But with all the strollers and distracted toddlers involved, it's really more of a crawl.
This is what happens when you incorporate children in all of your events, is that things kind of, you know, take a very organic approach to them.
When we arrive at Hale Cook, the appeal of the old building is obvious. It's a brick, 20s-era elementary school surrounded by a big play area in the middle of a picturesque neighborhood. The Friends of Hale Cook have even planted a community garden on the school grounds. The building is currently closed up and unused, and while it's gone through a few different uses in the past few decades, it hasn't been a functioning public school since the 1980s. Reopening this old building will require some renovations and upgrades, but the Friends of Hale Cook say they can stagger this cost over the course of several years.
With any building that's been closed for 3 years, obviously there's there would be an upfront kind of restart cost for the district to do that. So that's one reason why we've been looking at an organic strategy of growing the school small, starting small and then growing it over time, is that you could potentially reactivate a portion of the building and reopen the building with more students in the future. So we do know that there's some work that needs to be done on the mechanical systems and things like that. We would love to see an aesthetic overhaul of the classrooms and hallways. We have had a lot of community members. We have an interior designer who's come out and volunteered to even bring in a class that she's been working with to help us work on re-envisioning the classrooms. We have muralists and artists in the neighborhood who've volunteered to come out and help decorate the walls and things like that. So we believe that we can lend some support to the district to do that. But yes, of course, it will cost the district some money to reopen the building initially.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an estimate right now on what that might be, at least for the first year or so?
Well, with some of the changeover in the district, I know that they are going back to reassess the building. They had done that for us previously with our very early initiative. And actually, we have a meeting next month where they will come back to us with looking at what that plan is for reactivating the building.
Hale Cook would serve a pretty big area, from 75th Street to Brush Creek and from State Line to Holmes. Any child living in this area would be eligible to attend. Right now, the area is served by 3 elementary schools, Hartman, Page, and Troost, although interest in these schools is low. A study by the Kauffman Center shows that just 10% of children in this area attend non-charter public schools. The Friends of Hale Cook hope to not only change that, but to set a model for change throughout the district.
Another major point of what our effort has been is to create a replicable model that can be shown and demonstrated here in this neighborhood, which has extraordinary capacity in terms of high-level engagement and community support in general for a lot of things that happen in the Waldo Brookside neighborhoods. But if we could somehow replicate that high level of engagement in all of our schools in the district, we'd see increased performance throughout the district, and we think that that's a long-term win for both this neighborhood and the city at large.
The Friends of Hale Cook will finish their feasibility study in the next few weeks. Ashley Hand says that if they can show enough neighborhood support, Interim Superintendent Green has agreed to present the plan to the school board. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith. Still to come, some of the real estate practices used in Kansas City's history that racially divided the city and continue to impact our community. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Why do so many white people have no black friends? And is racial integration and equal opportunity for all even possible? These are some questions posed by author Tanner Colby in his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black. For answers, Colby visited Kansas City in 2009, among other cities. What he discovered was a history of discriminatory practices in real estate. J.C. Nichols once enjoyed the dubious distinction of being a national leader in developing and maintaining all-white communities. Susan caught up with Tanner Colby to learn more about how neighborhoods impact relationships and opportunity.
If we've had 40 years of affirmative action and school busing and fair housing and all these different policies, and yet in 2008 I still don't know any black people, then my life would have to be a pretty typical example of what went wrong. And so I went back to look at all the various places in my life, the school that I went to, the neighborhoods I lived in, the places where I'd worked. And not only were they all almost all lily white, they were all pretty textbook examples of the failures of integration. One was my high school in Birmingham, Alabama, which was your typical white flight suburb, much like, you know, Overland Park and a lot of the Kansas Johnson County suburbs, only with the added benefit of our school mascot being the Confederate rebel and our school flag being the Confederate flag. So it was pretty extreme in that way.
So part of this quest, if you will, brought you to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And you talk in your book about the fact, you point out that Kansas City wasn't always segregated.
Well, what happened was, before the Civil War, there weren't that many free blacks in Kansas City. And then with the economic opportunity that came with the Industrial Revolution and the oppression that enveloped the South with Jim Crow, many blacks did start coming west and stayed in Kansas City. And there was lots of economic opportunity for them there. And in 1900, there wasn't a single black neighborhood that was, you know, majority black. There was nothing you would call the black side of town. There was no east of Troost, west of Troost. People segregated by class, as, you know, will typically happen. And it wasn't until the black presence started getting larger towards the end of the 19-teens that they could be scapegoated the way they were in the South.
You make the point, and I think it's a good point, that there's been very little coverage about the real inside story of real estate and mortgage lending and how that really served to keep the country segregated. And one of the people that you talk about in your book, a Kansas Cityan named Bob Wood, was a major culprit in the Kansas City area in terms of segregating communities. Can you talk some about that?
The civil rights movement, you know, with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and the Jim Crow laws that were on the books, those can't be ignored. They have to be reckoned with and acknowledged because it's such a visible part of history. But, you know, real estate sort of buried in the ground. It's been very easy for us to avoid that story and not really reckon with it. And the reality of real estate is what it did in the South. Jim Crow was, you know, a legal apartheid. Blacks and whites in the South lived in relative proximity. There weren't really many big major urban areas in the South, and you had all these small towns, and you know, the white side of town was 2 or 3 minutes from the black part of town. But people kept their distance from each other because law and social custom demanded it. Well, in the North, you didn't have Jim Crow as a legal barrier to keep people separated. So what real estate developer J.C. Nichols did was he and other real estate developers sort of, you know, created this idea of white residential space that could be sold as a premium. And
now,
what that
now,
did—
why was yeah, that so important at that time?
Because it gave segregation a profit motive. It privatized it and turned it into a product that you could buy. And so in the South, losing the right to sit at a lunch counter that was all white had a lot to do with losing social status. And white people didn't want to lose the social status of having, you know, exclusive white spaces and department stores and, you know, and so forth. But to lose the value of your property, because we built up this mythology that all white property was more valuable and that a black person moving into the neighborhood took cash out of your pocket— which was a myth because it was real estate agents like Bob Wood who were destabilizing neighborhoods and destroying property values. But anyway, the point being is that once white people internalized the idea that black neighbors would cost you money, not just a loss in social status, well, then that wall was even higher and more impossible to tear down. Martin Luther King, for all his success in the South, when he went north into Detroit and Chicago and tried to march in white neighborhoods, he just had to turn back. I mean, he was pelted with rocks and you know, he as he said famously, people from the South ought to come to Chicago to learn how to hate. And it was when he touched the third rail of the real estate issue, and white people started to think that integration would cost them actual cash money. That was the wall we never got over.
Now, you indicate in your book that, in a way, Kansas City is the birthplace of what you call the segregated American cityscape. If that's true, would you call J.C. Nichols kind of the father of the restrictive covenants that kept neighborhoods white?
Yeah, I call him the Steve Jobs of racism. Because he didn't invent racial covenants. They had existed. Nobody really knows who was the first person to use them or to say you can't sell this house to a black person. Steve Jobs didn't really invent many things either. He appropriated and tinkered with other ideas that existed in the world and, you know, turned them into the Apple or turned them into the iPod. And what J.C. Nichols did was he took this idea of restrictive covenants and he really innovated them. He applied them not just to the house for sale but to the whole subdivision. And then he took the homeowners association and that everyone who lived in that neighborhood was a member of and made that homeowners association legally liable for protecting the whole neighborhood. So therefore, no one member could break the covenant without, you know, violating the contract of living in that neighborhood. And then he also, quite ingeniously, made your voting share in the neighborhood association based on the front footage of your lot, which means that if you had a handful of large property owners could outvote the larger number of owners of smaller lots. And so it was all these innovations that he created that really made the racial covenant ironclad, sought-after product.
There's something in your book that I certainly wasn't aware of, and maybe other people aren't either, that after creating, you know, the Country Club District and Mission Hills here in Kansas City, that J.C. Nichols went on to develop a national real estate organization that then influence similar segregated neighborhoods across the country.
That's one of the things that led me to Kansas City. I grew up in Vestavia Hills, which is sort of like the new money suburb of Birmingham, and then next to it was Mountain Brook, which was very much the Mission Hills of Birmingham. And turns out it was exactly the Mission Hills of Birmingham because the real estate developer from Birmingham was best friends with J.C. Nichols, and they were members of this group together. And when he was founding Mountain Brook in Birmingham, he wrote to his, you know, to J.C. Nichols and said, "Hey, can I use your racial covenants?" And J.C. Nichols said, "More than happy to." And he shared them and sent them on down. And Mountain Brook in Birmingham is a carbon copy of Mission Hills. I mean, there's a you know, country club plaza shopping center just the same as the one in Kansas City, except there's an English Tudor vision village instead of an Andalusian Spanish village. And the same thing happened all over the country. Forest Hills in Queens, New York, Highland Park in Dallas, you know, all these real estate developers. There was basically J.C. Nichols in every major city, and they were all friends. And they all were involved in creating the National Association of Real Estate Boards and creating national real estate board policy. And they were the ones who basically made it part of a realtor's code of ethics nationwide that, you know, introducing unfamiliar ethnic group to an all-white neighborhood is, you know, destabilizing. And it started with J.C. Nichols in Kansas City.
So enter Bob Wood that we've made reference to. Talk a little bit about what he's best known for and some of the tactics that helped the white communities become a place where more and more whites fled.
Well, yeah, as I say in the book, you know, J.C. Nichols built the supply and men like Bob Wood drove the demand. Wood was a blockbuster, as the process became known, which is that you would go to, you know, a block of white houses, and these are over on the east side of Troost where they weren't protected by the same racial covenants as J.C. Nichols' areas on the west side of Troost. And, you know, they would take a block and pick the weakest homeowner, like the elderly widow who was on a fixed income, and they would just start harassing her and saying, you know, "The coloreds are moving in. The blacks are moving in. Don't you think you should sell? I'll give you $5,000 for your house today, but if you wait, you'll only get two." And, you know, she'd be terrified. Or what they'd do, if they were particularly creative, a blockbuster would go in and buy a house themselves and then rent it to a black family. But they wouldn't rent it to a working class or middle class black family that, you know, would be the typical type of person to live on that block, they'd go and find recent released prison inmates, black people who fit the worst stereotypes that white people had, and then they would move them onto the block and then start calling all the white neighbors and saying, see, this is the element that's moving into the neighborhood. Don't you think you should get out? And it was all a scam. But the only reason it worked was because the federal government and the National Association of Real Estate Boards had created these all-white havens out in the suburbs, because you can only have white flight if you have some place to flee. So the government was building all this new housing stock out in the suburbs, and it was just 1, 2, 3. Real estate developers were creating a selling panic. So the first black family to move in might buy their house for, you know, $15,000 because they were, you know, that desperate to get out of the, you know, the tenements in 18th and Vine. Even though the house was only worth 10, they'd pay 15 for it. Well, then a month later, after having sold off the whole block, the average house value would have been driven down to 2,500. So not only did white families lose most of the value in their homes, but then black families would be left with these underwater mortgages that they'd overpaid for, and they'd default on the house, and then they would just rerun the scam all over again.
And as I understand it, because some of these blockbusters, Bob Wood in particular, they would finance houses themselves. They were having then all kinds of ways to exploit people and reap the benefit.
Right, because what happened was, you know, for years you had this federal program called redlining, which goes back to the Depression, which is that the federal government basically adopted the same policies as the National Association of Real Estate Board and said that the federal government wouldn't underwrite any mortgage in a mixed neighborhood or in a black neighborhood, and that, you know, all these veterans coming home on the GI Bill, their mortgage payments would be no good in a mixed neighborhood or a black neighborhood. And so all those people ended up going out to the city. And so blacks were denied mortgage credit, you know, because it was only available to whites. And so when they tried to fix this, in a rather misguided way, they said, okay, well, it's illegal to deny blacks credit, so the remedy to that is that we're going to make you give any black family credit. Well, the only thing worse than, you know, denying someone credit is giving them too much garbage credit that they can't afford to maintain, which is the exact same thing we saw recently in the subprime mortgage crisis. And so all of a sudden, the federal government had guaranteed that if these scam artists gave black people predatory mortgages and they defaulted on them, then they'd be insured by the federal government. So then it was, you could bring any black family in with no down payment, give them an inflated mortgage, and then when they default on it, the federal government would give you a check for, you know, 98% of the value of the mortgage. So these blockbusters like Bob Wood would start buying houses, and they just move black families through them, destroying their credit and leaving them with no place to be.
Well, and you know, of course, you talk about the truce line that everybody's familiar with, where east of truce is black and west of truce is white, and where you can't get pizza delivery east of truce, your insurance rates are higher, your real estate values are lower, and your life expectancy is lower east of truce. You argue, though, that all of that was created by some of these discriminatory policies that affected housing stock and caused blight.
Mm-hmm. It was more so that, you know, up until, you know, the Brown v. Board decision, the line wasn't as definitive. But before Brown v. Board, the 18th and Vine black neighborhood was kept in place largely by social custom and fear. There had been bombings for any black families that had tried to move out. But two things changed. One was Brown v. Board, which said that you couldn't have racially segregated schools anymore, and the other was just, you know, the rising civil rights consciousness of the, you know, the post-war black community, such that black families were more assertive and more willing to, you know, get out of the tenements, the overcrowded tenements of 18th and Vine, and move out into neighborhoods and face down the threats of white, you know, resistors. And once Brown v. Board outlawed segregated school attendance, then the Kansas City school system shifted from having racially defined school attendance to having neighborhoods defined on or having schools defined by neighborhood attendance. So then you had a system where you had to keep neighborhoods white. Before, you could have one black family move into a mostly white neighborhood and they could still be prevented from attending that school. They'd have to be bused back up to, you know, Lincoln High School or whatever. But after Brown v. Board, you couldn't have a policy like that anymore. So now they had to start shifting real estate barriers so that if a black family moved onto a block, well, then that whole block had to be dezoned from the white school and rezoned back north towards whatever schools, you know, black majority black schools were in the 18th and Vine area. And what sort of the city fathers said was, okay, well, we can't avoid this anymore because the Supreme Court's decided it. So we'll just let, you know, if blacks want to move out of 18th and Vine, we'll let the east side go black because that's where the working class white people are and where we need to really protect the middle class white people over on the west side. And so they just sort of drew a line down Troost and said – and sort of let people like Bob Wood know, you know, if you go out and do this blockbusting in the working class east side neighborhoods, we're not going to really bother you or come after you. But, if, you know, just stay away from the west side. And that's how the Troost Wall became what it is today.
This is Casey Currence. We're speaking with Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Tanner will be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library this Wednesday, October 10th. Go to our website at kcur.org for more information. Now, the one exception that you talk about, or one of the exceptions, is the 4963 neighborhood and its association. And, of course, people locally talk about that as one of the major integration, if you will, successes in Kansas City. Not so fast, you say, though.
Let's put it this way. It's one of the most successful integration experiments in the country, and by which I mean it's marginally successful. It's done many wonderful things, and it's built a foundation that it can continue to grow and become better, but it's by no means a racial utopia. For some people who live there, it is, and some people it isn't. What happened was, you know, when a black family moved into a neighborhood, it became a racially mixed neighborhood, and therefore, you know, it wasn't just blacks getting denied mortgage credit. You could be a white person, and if you wanted to move east of Troost, you'd get your mortgage denied. You know, middle-class white person with good credit, and you can't get a home loan, or your homeowner's insurance triples for no reason just because black families are moving in. And so that really sort of got white homeowners realizing, okay, this affects us too. We've all got, a stake in this. Let's band together to create an integrated neighborhood. And many communities had tried to do that on the east side going back in the 1950s, but none of them really had the toolkit to do it because they were just working class neighborhoods. But when they got to 4963, you had the university there, so you had a lot of university professors with law degrees and economics degrees, and you had the universities themselves, Rockhurst and UMKC, which had a sort of a vested interest in allowing blacks to come in and becoming integrated, but also keeping the stability of the area. So the 4963 group came together and drew a zone from 49 to 63 and from Oak to Paseo and said, let's try an experiment in integration. And from a property rights perspective, from a legal perspective, they did everything right. I mean, it was really just a textbook example of how to create a racially integrated, financially stable neighborhood. They got rid of people like Bob Wood and blockbusters, and they banned yard signs, and they banned these late-night solicitations of scaring people, and they really went after any predatory realtors who were breaking the law, and they created incentives for, you know, honest realtors. You know, they created their own home listing service so that realtors who would only conduct legitimate business would be first in line for legitimate home transactions. And they also formed their own mortgage lender called Neighborhood Housing Services, because if the banks were going to deny mortgage credit to blacks or if the banks were going to deny homeowners insurance to even to whites, they would create their own lending institution and let people work off their mortgage with sweat equity and really create, you know, a neighborhood. You know, the whole neighborhood's roughly 70% white, 30% black today. And they saved the houses, because before we had all these houses being flipped over and turned over and going into foreclosure, then the houses are falling into disrepair. And as you see on the east side of Troost now, whole swaths of neighborhoods are just rotted away and you have to tear them down. So they saved the houses and protected the houses, and they protected the legal and financial foundation of the neighborhood.
But one limitation, yeah, though, was, and that you point out, even though on the surface it's an integrated neighborhood, it's celebrated as such, the ability to form real friendships across the races continued to be limited.
Yes.
Why do you think this was?
You know, you had a number of well-meaning white people who wanted to have an integrated neighborhood, but even as in their good intentions, they couldn't really identify with, you know, the working-class black families that were moving in. You had, you know, college-educated university professors and mostly working-class, black people coming in who were working two and three jobs, and had their own social world that oriented back east to the churches and social clubs of the east side. People, you know, tried to get along. You know, they didn't really have the social toolkit to do it. And you see, you also had still a lot of working-class whites who were, you know, of your Archie Bunker type character, who they weren't going to run out to the suburbs, and they agreed to live among blacks, but they weren't too thrilled about it. And so, you know, I talked to Alvin Brooks, who was involved in city politics at the time, and he said he'd get a lot of complaints from the neighborhood where, you know, if the, you know, the black family's kids left their toys out on the white neighbor's lawn, the white people wouldn't just go over to the fence and say, hey, can we talk about your kids leaving their toys on our lawn, you know, like neighbors do. You know, they'd call City Hall and, you know, file a complaint because they weren't interested in having a relationship. You know, if you're neighbors with someone and their kids leaving their toys on your lawn, you go
talk
and
to
have
them.
Conversation. Yeah, you talk to them. But he said, I get calls from City Hall for, like, you know, picayune stuff that neighbors should just be solving themselves. And, you know, for the black community's part, they wanted access to a better life for their kids. They wanted access to the better schools and the better neighborhoods. But they didn't really know if they could trust white people. You know, they had a very well-founded suspicion of, are these white people here to actually be friends with us, or is this another blockbusting scam? You know, I did a chapter about church in my hometown of Lafayette, Louisiana, where I lived before I moved to Birmingham. And the priest who oversaw the integration of a church there put it very well. He said that white people's opposition to integration was based on, you know, imaginary stereotypes, black people being criminals, you know, blacks being, you know, lowering property values. And so once they actually encountered honest, decent, good, hardworking black neighbors, a lot of those stereotypes went away. Not all of them, but, you know, the more outrageous imaginary ones were like, oh, well, that was ridiculous. Why did we ever believe that? And so white people just sort of like, okay, well, you know, if I have some black neighbors, again, it's the population critical mass problem. Handful of black neighbors is no big deal. White people eventually got over that pretty quickly. But black opposition to integration is based on very concrete, well-founded reasons, such as, you know, being assaulted for moving into a white neighborhood, or having bricks thrown through your front window, or the, you know, the daily slights of your neighbors not wanting to interact with you or talk to you. And so as blacks moved into places like 4963, they had very good cause to sort of keep people at arm's length and be suspicious of them. But as I said in the book, that was mostly the parents. The kids who grew up in 4963 in the 1970s never knew any different. And that's one of the real lessons I took away from the book, is that integration is not something you do for yourself. It's something you do for your kids, because, you know, two 40-year-old people who've grown up in different worlds and different cultures, we're not necessarily going to become, you know, best friends overnight. We're just coming from two different places. But we can agree to, you know, respect each other and coexist with each other so that our children will grow up right next door to each other, not knowing any different.
Tanner Colby will discuss his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, on Wednesday, October 10th at the Kansas City Public Library. In addition to his current book, Tanner Colby has authored biographies of comedians John Belushi and Chris Farley.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, the aftermath of this summer's drought. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, the Kansas Supreme Court upheld the malpractice damage cap law, and medical research done at Children's Mercy Hospital got worldwide attention. KCUR's Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The test of a new genome analysis system at Children's Mercy Hospital involved diagnosing infants critically ill with genetic diseases. But Dr. Stephen Kingsmore said it has a much broader potential.
We can now consider whole genome sequencing to be relevant for hospital medicine.
Kingsmore hopes the new approach will become more widely available within the next year. The Kansas Supreme Court ruled on Friday that the state's $250,000 limit on non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases is constitutional. But the justices did express concern that the legislature hasn't raised the amount of the cap since it was passed in 1988. The Missouri Supreme Court recently ruled that a similar law was unconstitutional. Senator Claire McCaskill took in $5.8 million for her war chest in the quarter, likely setting a record. The money poured in after opponent Todd Akin said legitimate rapes almost never cause pregnancy. Meanwhile, challenger Akin went negative in his ad campaign.
The stimulus made McCaskill rich. More than $1 million paid to partnerships owned by McCaskill's family.
Several fact-check organizations said the accusations were exaggerations based on unsubstantiated assertions. Retiring Kansas Republican State Senator John Rattle endorsed Democrat Mike Delaney to be his replacement.
There are some people that are so dedicated to partisan politics that they will support the candidate of their party regardless of how bad that person may be. I am not one of those people.
Delaney's conservative Republican opponent Jeff Melcher called Rattle out of step with most Republicans. Supporters of a Missouri ballot measure to change the way top judges are selected scuttled campaign efforts. They said without a huge ad campaign, the ballot language, upheld in court, will kill the proposal. MU wide receiver Doriel Green Beckham, former number one college football recruit, and two other players were suspended for a week. MU Police Chief Brian Weimer said,
Officers determined that the individuals were in possession of less than 35 grams of marijuana. They were arrested for that.
The two other Tigers suspended are linebacker Torrey Boozer and receiver Levi Copeland. Also in sports, as the Royals set the record for the longest-running postseason drought in major American pro sports, manager Ned Yost fired hitting coach Kevin Seitzer.
We've got a group of young power hitters that are capable of hitting homers. Our offense was built more around, and it was like that last year and this year, singles and doubles.
Yost said the rest of the coaching staff will be back next season. This is KCUR.
In parts of the lower Midwest, while water-starved crops have collapsed, the farmers have not. Most of them have survived, and as KCUR's Frank Morris explains, some have even thrived during one of the driest summers on record.
Neil and Sons Dairy near Freeman, Missouri, looks pretty lush after a rain, especially with cows crowding in for a drink of fresh water.
But all summer,
Julie watched the pastures wither and the business unwind.
I honestly probably wanted to quit several times. Just hang it up. But there was a lot to that decision.
Farmers with animals got the worst of the drought this year. Feed grew scarce and extremely expensive. The Neals had to borrow heavily, about $50,000, just to keep their cows alive. Laborers lent encouragement and heavy equipment. The farm was in intensive care.
Honestly, I think it was on more of death row. It just didn't feel like it was ever going to end.
For the Neals, relief came with a name.
I wouldn't have picked Isaac. I would not have picked Isaac for a savior's name. But then we don't get to pick them, do we?
Eric Neal is talking about the remnants of Hurricane Isaac. The storm slammed Louisiana, but quenched large parts of Arkansas and Missouri.
We had 5.25 inches of rain here. We had no runoff. There were hardly any puddles in the driveway. Within 4 days, we had grass growing and my cows started grazing against it.
Today, Neil's cows stand in a field of bright green knee-high grass, gobbling their fill and making milk.
This way it's supposed to work. Yeah. This is a good day. It is a good day.
But just 45 miles west of here, near Baldwin City, Kansas, Isaac petered out, bringing too little rain too late in the season to help Luke Ulrich's corn. Ulrich pilots his big green combine, harvesting the last of this year's ragged crop.
Well, there's your last 8 rows of 2012, Frank.
That's it.
That's it.
It's not much, far less than half the normal yield. Pretty typical, though, across the lower Midwest, where drought torched billions of bushels of corn. Yet Jason Henderson with the Federal Reserve says farmers as a whole are doing well.
Here in 2012, USDA expects net farm incomes to reach their second highest level on record.
Record drought and near-record farm income?
It seems completely illogical.
Dave Swenson teaches economics at Iowa State University. He says the explanation has several parts. For one,
crop prices, grain prices, oilseed prices, wheat prices, prices are very, very high.
Unrelenting international and domestic demand for corn, coupled with a cut in production from the drought, have made for a very good year for farmers like Ken McCauley. McCauley farms in the very northeast corner of Kansas, an oasis in a desert this year, where good rains let him produce up to 20 times as many bushels per acre as farmers like Luke Ulrich got not far away. McCauley says 210 bushels an acre on some fields isn't quite the best yield ever, but
with these yields and the prices, I would say we're income-wise, we're right up there at the top.
And even guys like Roy Berghaus, who farms the hills near Farmington, Missouri, figures he'll make ends meet, though he's lost nearly two-thirds of his corn crop.
Prices is the only salvation, you know. Hopefully it'll keep the operation going.
While Berghaus doesn't carry government-subsidized crop insurance, most Corn Belt farmers do, and it's another major boost for farm income. It'll likely pay upwards of $15 billion this year. Jordan Ulrich, back in Kansas, will get some of that money.
Definitely the crop insurance helps, but everybody's situation is different.
Ulrich and his brother Luke, for instance, have especially high overhead. They rent farmland and carry a lot of debt. Crop insurance won't pay the mortgage. USDA is offering very low-interest emergency loans for farmers in their situation. Luke Ulrich says there's another factor.
We can't figure out how these soybeans stayed alive.
Newer hybrid soybean plants surprised a lot of farmers this year. They're expected to produce a fairly decent and very lucrative crop.
Whoop, my boss!
Back at the Neal's place, though, the drought is fresh in Eric's mind.
Do you feel like you're in the clear now?
No. I don't know if I'll ever feel like I'm in the clear again. I completely get now how my grandparents dealt with life after living through the Depression in the 30s. You're always saving and wondering and making sure that you've got enough saved back so that that kind of thing never happens again.
But the immediate crisis is over. Eric's turned a corner. The farm is no longer on life support.
A month ago, I was trying to decide whether or not I could survive as a farmer. And now it's not survive as a farmer, but what kind of farmer am I going to be? And how am I going to handle this type of thing in the future? I'm still a farmer.
So despite the worst drought in generations, Eric Neal and most other farmers are still in business. The American food production system has so far handled the drought better than anticipated. Most farmers will go into next year with the tools they need to keep producing enormous amounts of food, weather permitting. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Farmers who plant corn or soybeans in land susceptible to flooding or erosion know they're taking a leap of faith. This so-called marginal land is rarely productive, but Christopher Houston, reporting for Harvest Public Media, tells us there are crops that thrive consistently on this high-risk land, and some farmers are just beginning to discover the market potential.
This is Indian grass here. You see it starting to flower.
I'm walking around the parched rolling hills of western Missouri with Wayne Vassar. After this summer's drought, you might expect to see a desolate scene, yet hip-high native grass sways around us like seaweed in the ocean. Vassar is showing me some of the native plants he grows for biofuel.
So if someone had owned this land and wanted to plant corn or soy on it, what would happen?
Well, they've had corn and soy on it in the past, and what's happened is when you have this kind of slopes, it erodes pretty rapidly, and you lose a lot of your fertility as the topsoil goes down the hill.
Farmland experts call the ground we're standing on marginal land. Here, the hills make it difficult for the soil to hold on to nutrients. Along the rivers and other floodplains, frequent flooding can deprive plants the oxygen they need. It all adds up to an estimated 116 million acres in the central U.S. Land like this might only produce a profitable harvest with traditional crops once or twice every 5 years. And that's quite a financial risk for farmers.
How do you then avoid the risk factor and make sure that such soils provide an economic return for the landowners consistently? And that's where some of these biomass feedstock crops come in.
That's Shibu Joes. He's the director of agroforestry at the University of Missouri, and he says native grasses, or biomass, like the grasses Wayne Vassar is growing, have evolved naturally to survive in flood and drought conditions. They are cheap and require low maintenance. I'm talking about watering maybe once a season. The problem is the market for the native grasses, primarily for use in biofuel, isn't nearly as strong as it is for the occasional productive harvest of corn or soybeans. Trying to kickstart this market model is the Federal Biomass Crop Assistance Program, in which the U.S. Department of Agriculture subsidizes landowners who are willing to grow biomass for biofuel. Vassar is a part of that program, which was initiated by the 2008 Farm Bill. Back at the farm office, Vassar tells me that Show Me Energy Co-op, a biorefinery just down the road, buys his biomass as well as from a few hundred other growers, too. The co-op then converts it into pellets, which are then sold to coal plants for burning in stoves and even for cattle feed.
Right now, it's very lucrative, $100 a ton. It was half that, and if they have a really good stands of biomass, they can produce 3 or 4 tons per acre, so that's pretty nice little cash return per acre.
Ideally, the goal is to convert the biomass to liquid biofuel, like ethanol, for interested industries such as commercial airlines and the military. But Joe says the refineries that can actually do that are sparsely scattered around the U.S., which makes it too expensive for many would-be growers to transport their harvest.
Transportation is a major bottleneck when we talk about a bio-based economy. The reason being, you are trying to, you know, to transport a low-energy feedstock. You cannot transport that very far. If you do that, the economics behind it will disappear in a hurry.
In the meantime, Joe's says that even using a fraction of the marginal land available could help close the gap on a federal mandate for 21 billion gallons of non-corn starch biofuel in the nation's supply by 2022.
We estimate that based on the current level of productivity, if you convert 10% of the marginal land along the Mississippi River, we can produce up to 6 to 8 billion gallons of advanced biofuels from this corridor alone. And that would be about a third of the advanced biofuel target that we have as a country.
Back at the farm, Vassar drives me to a thicket of grass that looks like the bucolic backdrop of a family Easter portrait.
And even with this drought-laden, waterless summer, this grass looks pretty healthy.
It looks pretty good. Yeah, it's good. It's almost waist high, and it's had a cutting of hay taken off of it. And not much moisture this year.
Vassar says interest in growing biomass is building among landowners, especially in light of the drought. Indeed, the USDA's biomass program has a waiting list of farmers ready to jump on board. In Kingsville, Missouri, I'm Christopher Husted for Harvest Public Media.
Well, thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.